order, since we have a quorum. I just mentioned at the very end of the meeting that we'll be going into executive session. It'll be very brief, I assume. And then when we come back into regular meeting, we'll adjourn. So those of you that want to leave, when we go into executive session, just know that no other business will be transacted. Okay, the minutes of April 17th, the minutes of the April 17th meeting were mailed to you, emailed to you. The chair will entertain a motion to approve those minutes.
So moved.
Second.
Second by Marie. Any additions or corrections? Questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Approved. Thank you very much.
And how many pages were there? 13? Michaela, you did a good job.
Getting kind of expensive. I think they should start providing us with ink. Okay, you received also a copy of the advisory board appointees list in May, and hopefully you had a chance to review those. The chair will entertain a motion to approve those appointments. Colleen, you're second. Second, Joel. Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Approved. Thank you. Okay, program proposal. I'll turn that over to Dr. Doctor.
Thank you. In our attempt to continue to serve students, grow enrollment, we have several new programs that are building on existing strengths. The two current ones that have gone through the governance process so far is an AOS, which is an Associates of Occupational Science, in HVAC. This is, in essence, moving away from the certificate to offer an associate's degree. The enrollments in HVAC have been really flagging, and oddly, because we just can't get students into it, and yet there are jobs waiting for the students. So we're hoping this will make what is a very attractive career make the program attractive to students. The other one is EET Bachelor's of Science, Electrical Engineering Technology. We have an electrical engineering technology BTEC. The difference is that this is a completer degree. It's designed for a student who already has the associate's degree in electrical engineering technology, which we have, as does many other colleges in the system. But the EETBS that we're proposing here is designed to be an online program so that we can serve students who graduate from many community colleges with an EET associate's degree and help them to move forward on a bachelor's degree, which might give them career advancement opportunities, and us the opportunity to serve them and help them with their tuition money, moving it out of their accounts and into ours. You know, always happy to be of service. So obviously trying to serve the students in the industry by providing employees, but also capitalizing on what we do to increase revenues or enrollments and thereby revenues.
Any questions? Are there any other competing programs at that level? Anyone else in the SUNY system saying, hey, there's these associate degree holders, we need to serve them as well?
Not online. For example, Farmingdale had a comment because they have a bachelor's degree in EET and not an associate's degree, and they were concerned that we were going to encourage their students to bail and transfer into our program, and that's what shaped ours to have the admissions requirement of the associate's degree. So they couldn't bail because they don't have it as an associate's degree. But the online, which is a strength of Canon, makes us attractive. It would allow the student with the associate's degree to be working and still advance their career with a bachelor's degree.
Any other questions? Can we do all three of those together, Doc?
Sure. Just two.
Two.
AOS and EET.
Okay, the chair will entertain a motion to approve both. Tom, second. Go ahead. Any discussion, comments, All in favor?
Aye.
All right, cool. Thank you very much. The next item, you received a copy, it's a draft copy, right, Courtney, of the changes in the sexual harassment policy. We will not be voting on it today since it's a draft, but would the council be comfortable if we need to approve it before the next meeting, which is in September?
I don't think we're going to need to. You can still ask that question, but I think with the updated information
okay.
that we've received, I don't think that it's going to be moving forward for this,
right.
this coming fall. So.
But if we happen to be under the gun, would you be willing to approve it by email or telephone?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Okay, Courtney?
Okay, so the policy that Michaela sent out to you is a draft. It came from SUNY. It went through the president's listserv. It's gone to the Title IX officers and a few of the vice president's groups for comment and feedback. And it's at its heart, it's a consensual relationship policy. It's trying to address relationships primarily between employees and students, but also employees and those folks they supervise, so as not to so as to protect us in the instance of power dynamic issues. So I presume this came out of Michigan State and everything that has happened there with SUNY wanting to be proactive and the state getting involved. So they drafted a policy. We saw two first runs, and this is the third that Michaela sent out to you. Since she sent the policy, Suzanne McDermott, who's our director of human resources, went to her HR director's meeting where one of the SUNY attorneys who oversees human resources was there and said, this is not going to go forward for this coming year's academic handbook, student handbook at this point, because there's a new sexual harassment law that's making its way through the legislature that they feel will impact this, and that will change the policy and it'll apply to only your state employees. So this may be a draft that never sees the light of day, or it may be some iteration of this that then goes forward. So at this point, we wanted to provide it so you have an opportunity to see what we've seen and also to provide any comments that you may have. Because we are still communicating back with SUNY to share any concerns or feedback that we have. So I'm happy to add. I don't know if you want an overview on it or if you'd like to just ask questions or provide any comments.
And I should mention that, this is a topic that's in pretty heavy discussion among ourselves here at the college. And we've had various concerns and suggestions, which we've shared with SUNY, and I don't know if it's because of us or if they came up with these things themselves, but in some cases that moved in the direction we wanted.
The initial policy, and so in the document you received, there's the draft memo from SUNY, and then they also drafted a optional SUNY consensual relationship policy. So they sort of gave us a policy that we might use. That policy goes into greater detail. Initially, the language in the memo is sexual or romantic relationships. The draft policy that they provided goes into intimate relationships, which is a word that at least, Steve and I have spoken, and that's a little bit more gray. I don't think that's a word that I personally am comfortable with. I certainly don't want to try and manage the intimate relationships of my employee, and I don't think any of the rest of us do either. They also talked about academic department and campus units, so, not allowing people who are in an academic department with students to date them versus people who are just teaching a class and that student is in their class, so they have direct impact over their grade. All of this is completely up for discussion, but the drafted policy that they provided was interesting, I think, to say the least. It was far more where they started in the
moment. And again, just to give you some context, this turned up at the president's meeting, and they were talking about two different kinds of policies. First, the sexual harassment policy, and there SUNY wants to have a system-wide policy. So in other words, there won't be any, I guess campuses can always be more stringent, okay, but there they're talking about wanting to have the same policy on every campus. Whereas here, okay, for the consensual relations policy, they're talking about having a SUNY minimum, so to speak, and campuses can, you know, go higher than that if they choose to do so, and thereby allowing campuses some latitude based on local conditions. Okay, I questioned why that made any sense at all, right? In that if something was appropriate on campus A and not appropriate on campus B, and somebody on campus B then did it, they could easily argue, wait a minute, campus A allows this, right? Or the other way around, wait a minute, if campus B knows enough to ban this, why didn't you? Okay, if something bad happens. So that seems to me to be, you know, a recipe for a problem moving forward, but they felt that the more latitude for the campuses would be a good thing.
That's coming from the Board of Trustees?
Initially, I think, but also from the governor's office. And so, because, you know, there's obviously a lot of interest and concern on this matter, and so I'm not sure what the particular impetus was in this case. But I thought that was, you know, kind of an odd position to take, that there should be a consistent policy on the one, but allow some latitude on the other.
Did most of the presidents agree?
On what?
That it should be the same for all campuses?
I think there were presidents who liked the idea of having some latitude. And, you know, they held up, for example, Stony Brook's policy as being an especially good one. Now, I've never read it, so I'm, you know, I've got no opinion one way or the other as to whether it is. But if, in fact, Stony Brook's is the policy, then, you know, why would it not make sense to have everybody adopt it? Okay, is my view. And, you know, it just seems to me this opens the door for some easily foreseeable problems.
Could you tell if it was like more, they were more concerned with those from rural campuses as opposed to urban?
No, I couldn't tell.
You couldn't?
I didn't see any, but not a lot of people spoke on the subject. I mean, I raised the point, they answered. There was a little bit of buzz, and that was pretty much it.
Although, with the exception of the Title IX policies that we've been given, SUNY rarely gives a policy blanket to all the campuses. It's something that on the student affairs side and the student conduct side, we talked about why wouldn't one handbook for students make sense across the board? Theoretically, the types of things that we're concerned about students doing would be concerned at all 64 campuses, and if not, why? So, you know, it's something we talked about for years, but SUNY is really, really hesitant to do anything as a blanket, which is
fairly
frustrating. I guess
well,
the
that's
question.
A super restrictive policy, like child protection.
Child protection, as the other Title IX and Title IX right. My policy is
horrific. I guess the question I'm trying to get at is are the Board of Trustees actively involved in this, or are they just sitting back waiting for someone to give them? Here it is, vote on it.
Well, the impression that I got, though, you know, they didn't say that they'd taken a vote or anything like that, was that the Board of Trustees was interested in seeing this happen.
Because I question them, because, you know, obviously you've had a lot of input in this campus from the council members.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering.
And, you know, and again, we're trying to be helpful in this because, you know, like the word, when they added the word intimate, for example, I mean, the primary meaning of intimate isn't even what they're talking about. Okay? I mean, intimate just means close. Okay? And so I've got an intimate knowledge of chemistry. Okay? And so forth. And I had intimate relations with my co-authors because we worked together, right, in a common cause. That's, in fact, in any dictionary, that's the first meaning, okay, of the word. Okay, and in some cases, for it to, you know, be what they're talking about here, doesn't show up until the third or the fourth, you know, definition. And so it seems wrong to use a word that the most common definitions of have nothing to do with what we're talking about.
Particularly when in reality, sexual and romantic primarily covers the two things that we're concerned about. You know, those encompass everything that we're worried about. So it's an interesting addition. Like I said, in their suggested policy and out of the memo, so how you want to read that is up to discussion.
So anyway, we're trying to work with them to make it read better, and you know, I personally was happy when they moved from, you know, faculty member with direct supervision via a class or researcher, you know, whatever, to departmental, because, you know, we'd all draw the line in somewhat different places, but I thought that doing it just at the class level was a bit too narrow.
In all of these cases, sometimes compromise is not the best solution. And it looks to me, personally, I agree with you, would be that it should be uniform and for all campuses. And yet, some people would yell, I need autonomy, you know. And so they're trying to placate
sure.
everybody, and it doesn't always come out the best results.
And the trustees want it flexible.
Yeah.
They want everybody, all the colleges, to make their own decisions, and which makes it even
in
more
some
difficult.
Ways.
Only sometimes. I think at the end of the day,
yeah.
we're going to have zero input on a policy. We're going to vote on what we're told to vote on. I'm more interested in what's the local conditions, because once there's a policy, then you've got to live with the policy. What, just anecdotally, what do we know about this issue as it affects this campus? Do we have,
well, I'll tell you
on an ongoing basis, professors dating professors dating students, employee relations? Is it an issue that we're going to have to deal with, that you're going to have to deal with?
I will have to deal with the director of human resources.
Or
that's one of the discussions that we've had. Okay, so regardless of what the policy ultimately is, okay, there are going to be some things that are going to be allowed, and there are going to be some things that aren't. Okay, and we're going to have to then enforce that policy. So what we've talked about, okay, is how are we going to enforce whatever the policy ultimately winds up being? And one of the things that the policy calls for, which I'm very much in favor of, okay, is that if people are engaged in a relationship, even one that's allowed under the policy, they must disclose it. Okay? And so the first question, of course, is disclose it to whom? Okay? And so the answer that we came up with, okay, was to HR. Okay? And HR would then obviously have to look at the particular situation and say, does it fall within the guidelines or doesn't it? Okay? If it falls within the guidelines, then they would need to notify people's supervisors, right, to ensure that, because that's one of the major points of the policy, that this doesn't lead to an improper supervisory relationship. So, you know, you can't have a supervisor dating somebody who reports to them, okay, obviously enough. In which case, we would need to shift, you know, the person from being supervised with the person they're in a relationship to being supervised by somebody else, okay, for example. Okay, and if it doesn't fall within the guidelines, okay, then obviously the people would need to be informed that it doesn't, and that they would be in violation of SUNY policy or campus policy, depending on.
And then what do we do? I don't mean to be smirking about this, because I know this is important, but I feel like we're dealing with teenagers. You know, it's like when our oldest daughter was 14 and we looked at the boys in her class, we said, all right.
Not that one.
All of these boys over here, no way, you're grounded for life. You can date this one and this one, and that's it. I mean, we were.
She dated the ones in the other category.
Yeah, right. You set her up to go for the other ones.
Yeah, we said, these two are approved. You even look at these boys, you're done. Forget
it. That's what it was. It was with her.
So, I mean, I kind of feel like.
But that's the question, though, Tom. You know, in your scenario, if she dated one of the guys in the other pool, what do you do?
Oh, we had a full range of punishments all lined up. So, but we could do that because I know you can't. I guess that's what I was getting at. You
well,
can't.
We actually have discussed that point.
Yeah, are they grounded for a month or?
The other thing is, he said you'd have to come and disclose your relationship. Do you come hand in hand? Do you both agree?
Do you disclose on Facebook?
I didn't tell you this, but we've discussed every one of these things.
Great minds think alike. Suzanne McDermott, the HR director, had had actually seen sample forms for recording the disclosure and, in fact, said that the completion of the form with them would be done separately, so there's no coercive relationship going on in terms of the completion of the form. And then, well, what happens if it is a violation? She says, well, she said, well, then it would just fall into our normal disciplinary chain of events in terms of violating a campus policy. This is, you know,
could someone potentially lose their job over this?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
Yes, and so for
even
example,
if it's in a relationship that predates this new policy,
there are ways to around that. You just change the org chart. So in other words, I've had this experience. Department chair starts dating a faculty in the department. I've also had faculty members who were married in the same department. Co-faculty at one was at one time the department chair. And all you do is you say, okay, so you're not going to do the evaluation on your faculty member. We're going to have another chair do it, or we're going to default to the dean is going to supervise it. So you just find a way to undo the violation within, because you're going to have married employees in an organization. So there are ways to fix the thing that is in violation, which in essence is often the evaluation and supervisory relationship. And you can do that without changing jobs often. It's like, keep doing your job, but your performance evaluation is going to be done by either one up, skip a level, or a lateral. Yeah.
And Tom, it's not always obvious. Okay, I mean, in my previous college, as it turns out, we had a female department chair. Right, and her husband was a part-timer, okay, in that same department who reported to her, but she kept her maiden name after they got married, and so, at least from where I sat as the vice president for academic affairs, I didn't know they were married. I had no reason to know they were married, okay, and since they didn't have the same last name, it didn't occur to me that they might be married, okay, and I found out subsequently that they were. And we did exactly what Doug said. We had it so that he did not report to her, but rather reported to the dean, okay, which made a lot of sense, okay, and which was a good thing, okay, because they subsequently got divorced, okay, and obviously if he had been reporting to her, this could have led to an ugly set of circumstances. And that's why you have to look at these things and then why you have to adjust the supervisory relationships. Now, obviously, stuff like that, isn't going to lead to loss of job or anything like that, okay? But you can easily imagine circumstances that might. And so, we have a policy, let's say the policy from SUNY in its current iteration winds up being the policy, okay? And so that would forbid a faculty member to have a relationship with a student in their own department, okay? Let's say one did that anyway, okay, and didn't disclose it, and then we found out. Okay, well, that would certainly have some serious consequences, right, that would involve the union, that would certainly involve a counseling memo at the very least, okay, and if they persisted, okay, in that behavior, it would probably result in termination.
I think a number of people have found their spouses in the work site, so, but maybe you could, on the college website, you could put, like, an update list every morning. John is seeing Susan now, and then the next day, John no longer seeing Susan.
I really love not being the director of human resources. For whatever, throw it in for whatever it's worth. We do actually currently have a policy on the employee students. So the employee student, half of this does exist. It's pretty vaguely specific. Is that a ridiculous sentence? In that it gives specific examples like hall directors can't date students in the residence hall and university police officers can't date students. It gives a couple of specific examples, like then professors in the classroom. So the student side sort of exists, and we run into it every once in a while.
Especially on a campus where there are post-traditional students, right? It's not as odd to think, when you think of a 50-year-old dating an 18-year-old, when you think of a 50-year-old dating a 50-year-old, it's an entirely different circumstance, and that can still be a staff or faculty and student relationship.
So these things are complicated, but again, what we wanted to do is, to treat it in a serious way, and to not just say, here are the rules, please obey them, and from this point forward, we're closing our eyes.
Sorry, we're not helping you in a serious way this morning.
Yeah. But, you know, we thought it was important to have, you know, a real policy that at least made some logical sense as to how we would enforce it.
Maybe Michaela should judiciously edit.
It's an all snark removal.
This policy affects me, right? I will have to disclose the relationship with my husband, who also works on campus. It's a pre-existing relationship. It's, you know, it's, we were married when we came. Mm-hmm.
But they have different last names, and, you know, had I not known, right, that could have an effect on something. And, of course, I did. Right? And so if there was, you know, a supervisory relationship, we'd have to change it.
Thank you, Courtney. Is there any old business to come before our meeting today? I'm not aware of any. I do not have anything to report, so we'll move on to the President's report.
Thank you. Well, to start with, graduation went well. Okay, we had some 900-plus students graduating. About half of them walked, and about half of them earned honors. And you would be very proud when I asked my usual questions. Of, you know, those of you who held a part-time job while going to college, please stand up, essentially everybody. Those of you who held a full-time job, many. How many of you held a full-time or a part-time job and raised a family? Good numbers. How many were first in your family? Right? About 35%, I'd say. Right? We asked how many in our students, but also in the audience, served in the military.
Yes.
Right, and, you know, help defend our country. And we have good numbers standing up. And then, of course, the question where everybody stood is the, and how many of you benefited in one way or another from financial aid? Right, and essentially everybody did. And in fact, I think literally everybody did. Okay, and so, you know, again, it's a nice thing, and the students get to see, and the audience gets to see, that, you know, the hill is a little higher for many of our students. In order to successfully graduate, because they're not just, you know, your typical 18-year-old going to college and doing nothing else. Okay? And there's a lot more to it. Recognition Day also was well attended and went well. The winners of the President's Meritorious Service Award included faculty member Lucas Craig, and that was very cute because his wife and he don't keep secrets from each other, and we asked her to keep this. And then when it was announced, she goes, I kept the secret! That was very sweet. And also our Director of Financial Aid, Carrie Cooper, and our Executive Assistant to the President, Michaela Young.
Yeah.
So, and for the second time in a row, the staff won the Faculty Staff Trivia Challenge. Right? So faculty, we need to up our game. Okay. With regard to enrollment, last time I told you that enrollment was down a little bit. Now I can tell you it's up a little bit.
Oh, great.
Okay, in terms of deposits. And so this is an improvement from when we last spoke about this. And similarly, housing deposits have improved and are now even with last year. Okay, and so things look like they'll be either even or slightly ahead. Issues that arose from the President's meeting, probably the biggest one, is that, and this has been publicly announced now, agreement has been reached between the unions and the state about the salary increases. Okay, the unions will be voting almost immediately, if they haven't already done so, as to whether they will ratify the agreement. All indications are that they will. And the raises will be 2% per year plus 1% additional discretionary per year. For, is it 5 years or is it 6 years, Sean?
I think the first year discretionary is the 600 and then 1% a year after that.
So but I mean, is it for 5 years or is it for 6 years?
Discretionary.
No, the
agreement. Contract is 6 years.
6 years. Okay, I couldn't remember. And unfortunately, you know, that's obviously good for our faculty and staff, right? They certainly have worked hard to earn the money. Okay, but the bad thing is that the state has thus far not agreed to pay for the raises. Okay, and so this leads to financial complications for all SUNY campuses. Okay, and so Sean, would you like to talk about this?
I mean, I haven't run a lot of the numbers yet. I did just sit down and dirty on UUP this morning. Our UUP numbers are around 16.3 million. So if you add 7%, basically, so 2%, 2%, 2% is what is going to end up being added to base. And I threw in a 1% just for some of the retro and the $600 not on base. For in place of their discretionary for this year. Just for UUP, that's $1.1 million added to our base budget for next year. If you throw in CSEA, that's another $300,000 to $400,000. MC is another $100,000 probably. So we're looking at 1.56. A lot of it shakes out, depends on how long the people have been here. You know, because we're going back 2 full years, we have a lot of new people. So they don't get the retro, they don't get, it's not the same, the calculations will all be. So it's just a rough number, $1.5 million added to our base budget, but it's still a big deal, and I'm still pretty nervous about it. So the only good thing is when people get a raise like that, we've been having a lot of one-offs, people that haven't gotten raises for 3 years, and so they think that you don't appreciate them, when in fact they will get their retro money. And so I don't expect those people to be coming forward the same. Hopefully they'll be satisfied with what the contract has provided, at least for this year, hopefully next. Because there's not going to be a lot extra to give them. We've put in our revenue projections for next year. I kept our numbers flat. Because there's the Excelsior Scholarship, we have gotten some money back. Many campuses have still not gotten a dime back. We're manually certifying the students that we had. We had 155, give or take, and so I asked that my financial aid staff and the registrar staff would actually start going through them and manually certify them and submit them the money. So we've actually been doing that. How many students will we have next year in Excelsior? No idea. All I know is that last time the window of opportunity was like three weeks in the summer, by the time they got their stuff together and got it open on the website. This year it's been 3 months, so I have no idea. And just because they apply doesn't mean that they can get it. And so then we have to go through and manually say, because last year there was like 300 that actually applied for it, but only 155 qualified. So again, tons and tons of manual labor to try to figure out who can actually be awarded and who can't be awarded. So, you know, people still don't understand that it's a completion scholarship. You've got to go through all the way. If you've got a two-year program, you've got to finish your 2 years in 2 years. If it's a four-year program, you've got to finish your 4 years in 4 years. And so every semester there's a ton of work that goes along with this. And again, and the other piece of that is that their tuition rate is frozen at 16-17. So we get a $200, so we've had $200 tuition increase for 17-18, every student except the Excelsior students. And so when we go to 18-19, if we get the other, I believe that we'll have another $200 tuition increase, except the first year Excelsiors and the new Excelsior students. No tuition increase, so we'll be at 16-17 rates, yet salaries will be, you know, 7% higher for the campus to absorb.
So to clarify, the tuition isn't frozen in the year the students enter, it's frozen at 16-17?
I believe that's the way it is. Okay. That's the way it looks like on our revenue projection sheets. So, and again, may I have a question?
No, I was just going to say there's some talk that they're going to change that and move it to a cohort model, which will be based on the tuition in the year that they enter.
Correct. Yeah, and that makes far more sense. Far more sense. Yeah. But to my knowledge, they haven't done that yet.
Correct.
So, but of course, they haven't paid out many dollars. I haven't heard of any campuses. We had to reach out from the finance people at SUNY. You because they were going to start a push on DOV to at least try to get fall money back to the students, because that was guaranteed. You were guaranteed to be, you know, have the money in the program. But to my, what I saw, the emails going back and forth, I didn't see any campuses that had gotten money back. We were one of the few that decided to manually certify students and try to get some of those dollars back. We're sitting at about $700,000.
And y'all will recall that when we discussed this, when Excelsior first came out, we thought that there might be a problem with cash flow for campuses, and that's exactly what Sean is talking about.
Right. So, again, you know, things will be tight for next year. I mean, if we are lucky enough to have a little bit of increase in enrollment, you know, I see our cash flow, it being, this is going to be part of the problem, you know, and how that all shakes out. And then now you're going to start seeing students fall out of the program as well, because they have to have 30 credits a calendar year to stay in the program. So where they were guaranteed for fall because they gave them the benefit of the doubt, now you're going to see students start filing out. So then what happens with that? What happens with our money? What happens, how does this, the state gave them a zero interest loan for the Excelsior scholarship. How are they going to track that? Are we going to have to track that? How's that all going to work?
So, ready, fire, aim.
Yeah. So that's kind of where we are with our finances. It's kind of messy right now,
Sean,
I think.
Sean, you had mentioned to begin with that some had received increases, depending some of the staff or some. Is it pinpointed as certain staff that would receive increases and others that wouldn't?
You mean these raises, these contractual raises?
Yes.
Everybody will get them.
Everybody regardless?
It's a contractual. So whatever the UUP contract is, those UUP members will get those raises.
Okay, there were situations where, because of regulation, some in certain echelons of providing whoever the staff may be, mm-hmm. where they would be singled out to receive increases alone and not others receiving the same increases. Is there any situations like that? I know from our agency,
mm-hmm.
We have 150 employees, and we just gave increases based on what the state told us we could do for certain types of people, direct care staff with degrees. But it created all sorts of problems with some of the others who thought they were deserving as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it became quite an issue. But that isn't the case here.
Are they union members?
No.
No. So that's the difference. So you have a level of discretion for sure.
Okay.
If they're not union members across the board, a union contract, that's what we pay them.
Okay.
No ifs, ands, or buts.
So I know everybody gets.
I mean, this year we did have a few one-offs. People that came forward felt that their job duties had increased. They wanted raises. some of those things. But we were outside of a contract, and there were people that their duties had changed and their salaries hadn't changed. And so we would always bring those to the VP group and discuss those before they would be awarded. Yeah.
Well, what we did is brought the others up as well
mm-hmm.
through funds we had derived through our foundation.
Right.
So
CSEA, they signed their contract, and they paid out their retro and their raises last October.
Yeah.
And so these particular raises and retro payouts won't come until the 18-19. They're looking at maybe September, first week in September to ratify is what I'm hearing. So they won't even get theirs till fall. And the retro dollars, which go back to July of 16, will be split between 2 years. So that's going to help us as well. I don't have to come up with all of that at one time. So that will be helpful.
Do all employees receive an evaluation annually?
Yes.
All?
Yes.
Faculty?
Yes.
Yep.
Is there provisions in there for recommending an employee for we used to call it a step increase? You know what I'm saying? What do you call
it? We don't have that, but we do have at least the possibility of people identifying somebody who's, in effect, the franchise player. Okay, for their department or whatever, right? And that, that's kind of what Sean is talking about, right? So that we don't lose them to other institutions or whatever, we sometimes will make adjustments on that basis.
We used to call those merit raises.
Yeah. And we do, and the discretionary is the merit part of this, although SUNY is being a little more prescriptive this year, though it's in a way that we already said we were going to do, which is, so it's fine with us, right? And that they're saying half of the discretionary should address issues of compression and salary inequity. And we were going to do that anyway. And so if there are no more questions on that, obviously if the current situation continues to be the case, meaning continuing raises but no funding, okay, then the various campuses will start going into the red.
Yeah.
And so several campus presidents at the president's meeting indicated great concern, okay, about this, and indicated that their campuses are either in the red now or soon will be. Okay, most can, you know, figure they can handle the first year of it, but after that, large numbers start going under. And so some of them announced, for example, that they were freezing hiring and having no replacements for any retirements, which is, of course, a very bad way of doing business. Anyway, we want to avoid needing to go to these kinds of extreme measures, and so we're going to be initiating discussions with our faculty and our staff to let them know about the seriousness of the situation and to let them know that we want to take steps to increase revenues, cut costs, and increase efficiency in order to avoid falling into this trap. And so while we're not currently at risk, since we have strong reserves here at SUNY Canton, we don't want to see these reserves eaten up, which they certainly will be year after year if we don't take these steps. And so we're going to work closely with our faculty and our staff this coming year to identify strategies in a collegial fashion that'll move us forward. And so, Doug, would you like to talk a little bit about some of our initial plans?
Sure. In terms of revenue, that's all primarily about enrollment. And so our enrollment management working group and I have focused on what we're calling three pillars of enrollment management, one being recruitment, targeted recruitment into under-enrolled programs. And so those are programs that maybe a class lab classes have a cap of 25, and if there's only 18 or 16 or 15 students in there, we're teaching to empty seats. And if we were to increase the number of freshmen coming into those seats, it wouldn't cost us more because the seats are already there. And that actually already began 2 years ago, and for example, admissions was working closely with several programs in Camino, and the freshman class in mechanical engineering went up by 13%. So just by saying, all right, we're going to do some focused effort, time, money, and effort into specific programs rather than just recruiting generally to the college, has really yielded specific numbers into enrollment. So targeted recruitment into under-enrolled programs. And another pillar, which is often forgotten about, is retention. We often think about retention and graduation rate as what we do to serve students, because that's what we're trying to do, is help them graduate. But retention is very important, because if students don't come back, we don't get year two's revenue from them. So, for example, my first year, your retention from first year to second year was 61%. And that means that 39% of our students, let's say 4 in 10, we bring in a class of 700 freshmen, 280 of them don't come back, which is important conceptually because we want them to get their degrees to launch their lives. Financially, it's important because they don't give us money the next year or the year after that or the year after that, so it compounds across those years. So for many reasons, focusing on retention is really important. We've moved that this fall, retention was 71%. We've moved it 10% in 3 years. So that's 70 additional students who come into their sophomore year, and of course then proceed beyond that. And most attrition happens from fall to spring, or fall to fall of freshman and sophomore year. So that's really important for many, many good reasons. And so we're working on that. Our SUNY Excel's goal, which they asked us to set goals in 2015 for 2020, at that point our goal was 73% for 2020, so we are almost there. And that that number is on the academic affairs dashboard, and it's also on the college-wide dashboard because it's such an important number. So we have recruitment into under-enrolled programs, retention, and the third pillar is development of new programs. So as we develop, you know, computer game design and development, and so, and you know, the HVAC AOS and the EET online completer degree, all of these, especially when they use some courses that already are in existence, are ways to bring in additional revenue and, of course, serve students better. So quantity and quality is important. Retention is not about doing more, it's about doing better. So our efforts to serve students in richer ways, have an engaging campus life, have closer relationships between faculty and students, but not intimate, just closer, work-related, don't be careful. But all of those things, having the faculty and the student experience, keeping the career goal in mind, because that helps students stick. So keeping, increasing career services presence on campus, many, many ways we can help students stick, basically, and move forward to graduation, all along giving us money to support the college. So those are the three focuses. And on the expenditure side, in the big expenditure in a service industry is salary. And academic affairs has most of the salary because we have all of the faculty, and we are, you know, the direct service of teaching. So in terms of revenue expenditures, I'm looking mostly, you know, I can trim the edges and say don't buy so many Post-it notes, but that's not going to move the dial on anything. It's salary. And so each year we track separations from the college, people who leave or retire or for whatever reason leave. And what I do is I keep track of not just who separates and what program they're in, but most I keep track of the dollars so that come spring, I go to Svi and Sean and say, this is how many dollars we've separated in academic affairs, how much can I search? And then we go into a room, and it's sort of like a cage fight. Now, it's a virtual room in terms of the conversation because we have competing priorities. I want instruction to be strong, and Sean's job is to balance the budget, and so we're wrestling with those competing priorities to come up with an idea of, okay, it would be responsible to spend this much. And then and we all cross our fingers with Sean that the admissions brings us the class and the retained students come back. So Sean and Zvi say, Doug, you can spend this much money. In parallel, the deans have listed the positions that they'd like to search. And we go into our room, and it's like a cage fight, and we say which one is the most important. And one dean says this one, and the other dean says no, this one. Actually, it's very collegial. And we try and come up with a ranking so that when we say we can search three positions, there they are, one, two, three. I check them with V, because V is also over academic affairs as well as over the budget. But in essence, what we just recently did was we went back and said, okay, we've got three. Let's relook at our priorities list, because now that the line is being drawn, is it still that way? And confirm what we wanted to do. So we're being really careful about recognizing the salary increases with the modest tuition increases and our enrollment projections against because salaries are the big numbers, and they can be long-term commitments.
And that's part of the reason why, when we're talking about off-cycle increases, that we've all committed to bringing all of them right to the vice president's group, so that everybody will have the opportunity to bring in, you know, any pertinent information so we can make the most informed and fiscally responsible decisions. And that's the way we're doing it. And so it's very transparent, and I think it's very fiscally responsible because we want to maintain our strong fiscal position right going forward. And there are many campuses that are not in this kind of position. They're in a much worse position. Right. And that's why they have to take, I think, extreme actions. And that's why we want to avoid having to do that. And so we'd rather do this strategically as opposed to be faced with a problem and have to deal with it, with an across-the-board cut, okay, which is, you know, never a good idea. So anyway... So other issues that arose at the president's meeting include a push to make campuses 100% tobacco-free. It seems to be growing in popularity, and how to handle MMR, that's mumps, measles, and rubella vaccines. And also, the system seems to be getting interested in creating a fund to allow campuses a little more latitude in scholarshiping students to increase revenue, but you'd have to pay some of your increased revenue back to the system to replenish the fund. And so they're looking at that as a possibility. It's not a bad idea, right? The devil's in the details. And so we'll see what happens there. So that's pretty much everything from the president's meeting. We just finished our alumni weekend, and there's, I think, a lot of good things to report there. So, Anne, would you like to say a few words?
Yeah, so we did just have alumni weekend this weekend, and I'd say a highlight of it was our 50 Years on the Hill gala dinner, which some of you in this room attended. It was a wonderful evening, very festive and fun, and we had about 160 people there. So it was a resounding success all around, and a nice kickoff to the weekend. The 50th reunion class had a really good turnout. That was the class of 68, the first to graduate from this campus. And we are thinking that it may be that we see more engagement from graduating classes, especially around the 50th. Because from here on, all the classes will have attended college on this campus. And there's definitely a stronger sense of community that we see among alumni. So we're feeling positive about what that means for the future and generating interest in classes. We also, there's never been fundraising activities around reunion in here before. So that is asking people to make a gift in honor of their reunion. So it hasn't been class competitions or really asking people to make gifts in honor of reunion. So we focused on the 50th class this year to kind of get that launched. And they came through wonderfully with gifts and pledges, because in the 50th we'll count 5 years of pledges and planned gifts. So they committed over $277,000, which was wonderful. And so now we're going to use that as a challenge to future 50th classes and really start getting the sense of reunion anniversaries as not only a motivation to come back to campus, but also a motivation to give for alumni. We will have that, be building that. And that's part of our overall effort of engaging alumni that we've been working on the last few years, with more outreach, more events, reaching out to new people, just broadening that base so that we have in our giving a broader base of people, and that leads into ultimately a good pool of major gift donors, so that we aren't relying on just like two or three people to come through with the big gifts, but that we have a pipeline of donors who are being cultivated and coming up to the point where they'd be able to make larger gifts. We have already this year surpassed our overall fundraising goal for the year with a month left to go, which is tremendous. And to me, that says that all of these new things that we've been doing and the work that everyone in the office has been doing is paying off. And just to comment, since we've talked a lot about enrollment and college finances, our people in the foundation, we've all been part of an effort to become more strategic about how we are awarding scholarships as a campus. The foundation has scholarships, admissions has scholarships, financial aid has financial aid. So we've all been working together to streamline that process, improve it, and also look more broadly at how we're using the dollars overall in the interest of increasing enrollment and getting students who are admitted to decide to come here and retained as well. And I think it's even a more complex process than even we thought at the beginning. And we knew it was a complex process, and we've made a lot of strides as we get into sort of doing things in the new way that the group has come up with. We now are troubleshooting issues that have come up, but the wonderful thing is that it's a really good group working together, and I think we'll, and certainly hope, that we'll be seeing the impact of that, because we can be targeting the dollars towards the students that we really want to come. targeting dollars that keep students here so they don't drop out because they hit some financial hurdle.
Thank you, Ann. Any questions for Ann? Yeah, we've had, so as Ann said, we've had a very successful year in terms of fundraising, and so a lot of praise to the folks, to Ann and to the folks she works with, okay, because, you know, we've had trouble reaching goals in the past and to actually surpass them with a month to go, right? You know, no way of looking at that other than positive, right? So we're very happy about that. And speaking about progress, we've also been doing a lot of grant writing and continuing to push to develop the Entrepreneurship Accelerator. So, Lenore, would you like to say a few words about that?
Sure. So we did receive notification of a $250,000 grant from National Grid, which helps with the renovation of Dana Hall, where the on-campus version of the accelerator we hope will be located. So that's very helpful. I think most, if not all, of that work has been completed, so that kind of shifts that $250,000 to other work within Dana. So quarter of a million is always good, although it's a very good project. We also submitted a grant to the Northern Border Regional Commission, which is a federal organization, for $250,000. We submitted that on May 8th and hope to hear midsummer-ish if that money has been awarded. I had a very good conversation with the state representative. It's a unique grant in that a state representative from the Department of State actually scores the grant, and that carries a bulk of the weight in terms of how the funding is allocated by the federal government. So I had a very good conversation with the state representative. He was very positive about the project, so I'm hopeful. I also worked very closely with the Village of Canton to submit our downtown revitalization initiative proposal for the North Country Regional Economic Development Council, the $10 million grant, which goes to one community in the North Country. There were four applicants in the region: Saranac Lake, Messina, Potsdam, and Canton. The jury's out on whether those things are decided long before they ever see an application. but you can't win if you don't play. So we worked really hard on what I think is a very strong proposal, and the accelerator is a featured project within that proposal. I think particularly as it relates to the hopeful renovation of the eyesore downtown, I think that is definitely a feather in our cap as far as that goes. The Economic Development Agency within the Department of Commerce also has a couple of grants. One is an I-6 challenge, which is a $750,000 grant, which the funding was just allocated for centers of innovation and entrepreneurship. They also have a much larger grant, which can go towards construction, which is unique, and that's a $3 million grant. The funding for that has not been allocated yet, but I'm keeping an eye on the website, so as soon as that's allocated, we can put an application in. That's one of those first come, you know, better chances kind of situations. So we're working hard at finding the funding to get this thing off the ground. And what we're seeing is really tremendous support, not just from the local community, but from our state representatives and our federal representatives. Senator Gillibrand's office has been very, very supportive and very, very positive about this project. One of the next steps is that several of us are going to visit New Kensington, Pennsylvania, where the chancellor has done something fairly similar to what we'd like to do here. So we want to see what he's done, how he did it, what his progress has been. He came here and gave presentations to not only campus folks, but also regional stakeholders. I'm really interested to see kind of firsthand what he's done there. So this is a project that's definitely on the forefront of our work and certainly the work in my office.
And I'll be meeting with our town and village officials later this week, right, to update them on the project and to try to get some very specific support. And so I think this is an exciting opportunity for the region and for the college. So this may be one of those rarest of things, which is a win-win-win situation. Karen, any faculty issues?
We've been busy with new curriculum items. I think there were 46 at our last meeting. 45 of them went through. One was tabled, discussed in the fall. They submitted a new policy in terms of transfer credits. That what we've been doing is if you just take a course someplace else, unless you get a C or better, we won't transfer it in. However, if you have an associate's degree and you're trying to transfer in the entire associate's degree, if you had a D in there someplace, a few of them, we would transfer it in. They've changed that, or they're trying to change that policy so that we will accept transfer credits of a D. It will make us a little more transfer friendly. Transfer students have to have an overall 2.0 to come in, so it's not like we're taking in a lot of students with a lot of D's. But it may help a few, just give them that, you know, 3 or 6 extra credits when they transfer in to make it a little easier to finish. Those were the highlights in the last meeting.
I have a question. If a student fails or doesn't do well in the course and then repeats it at another institution, supposing they get a B or an A where they got a D before, does their cumulative point average, I mean, do they get credit for the B now? Or some colleges just give them credit for passing the course, but don't raise their GPA.
That's
know.
Correct.
So which
yes,
way
get,
is it?
They get credit, they get the credit, the 3 hours, okay, but it does not affect their GPA.
Okay. The grade I always thought that was unfair.
No transfer, your GPA at Canton is your GPA of course is taken at Canton,
okay.
Regardless of what it is. If you repeat the course at Canton, that you took a course here and you got an F or a D, you repeat it here, they both things remain on the transcript, but the higher grade is what goes into your GPA. If you had an F, that 0
well,
is
at least
removed.
That's good. Yeah.
So there's a benefit then if someone does poorly to suggest that they retake it here versus somewhere else.
I'm not aware, Marie, of any institution who does that differently. Okay, I don't know of any institution who transfers other people's grades into their own GPA.
I guess
we used to.
Into our GPA?
Yes.
If you took the course here and failed it at whatever degree grade got here, then we took the course at another campus, we would drop out the F.
Right.
Bring the new higher grade in. We changed that when Joe Hoffman was president.
Yeah, that's really unusual.
That's what he
I've never
he was
heard
quite
of it
adamant it wasn't what we should be doing. So
that's why I asked the question.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a lot of our students, they can't come back and take it. You know, in summer they can take it maybe someplace close by.
Or online.
And I had online, and I had a student who. There were some personal difficulties. I always remember this and didn't pass, not because of lack of ability or trying, but just some circumstances, and then got an A at another institution, and it didn't raise the grade point average, and I felt bad for him, you know.
Sure.
But I just, I don't know, we're not going to change the world today.
Okay. Anything else, Karen? Okay. Finally, Travis, I know we've been getting some amazing press lately.
excuse me, we have. one of the things I wanted to talk about was the summer session record that we just got. So we have more than 2,000 enrollments this year, so that's the 5th consecutive summer session enrollment record that we've broken, and that's the 9th consecutive off-term session that we've broken. And a lot of that revenue that's generated helps out with some of these other things to offset some of these costs. But also, we are reinvesting some of that money into marketing. And last time I mentioned a little bit, we had started and only had a couple weeks under our belts. But we started in March 22nd, it was. So we have over a month's worth of data. Not a lot to draw a ton of conclusions yet, but... in terms of our vet services ad that we had been running, we had pushed it out there and got 1 million impressions. It was actually viewed 363 times, and that's like from start to finish, so that's pretty good. And from there, we had 4,000 clicks, which went to our website. Our general ad that we put out there had 1.8 million impressions. So that's how many times we pushed it out there, of course. And 10,000 clicks from that ad. So looking at kind of the funnel, obviously we're hoping to get students in seats at the end of this. It's a little too premature to kind of draw those conclusions yet, but one of the ways that we're trying to see if this is actually working is the actual web hits that we're getting on the website. So we looked at the cities that we were actually targeting, and that's in New York State, New York City, Albany, Buffalo, Rochester, and Syracuse. And we've been sending them to our online learning homepage. So from the previous year, we only had 54 people hitting our site from those areas, which is not a lot. But that has increased to 1,158, so definitely a dramatic increase there. Out of state, Boston, Baltimore, D.C., Atlanta, Raleigh, Charlotte, Tampa, Orlando, Toronto, out of state. We had 372 hits from all those areas in the last year, and in the last month we've had 4,680, so that's a dramatic increase to those pages. Now the next step is actually converting those into students in the fall, so we're not quite there yet, and hopefully we'll figure out, you know, how to get them here, or at least online, but that's definitely, some promising evidence that people are seeing us, and we're at least getting our name out there, even if they're not clicking, but seeing the actual clicks onto our website are fantastic. So
it's amazing what you've done with social media.
It's great.
Yeah, tremendous.
And what we're seeing now, I just was looking at some research that, the younger generation is not using Twitter and Facebook as much, so we're going to have to quickly adjust and adapt and try to find other ways to, to reach those upcoming students. So it's exciting, but it's definitely challenging as well. So Greg Kai and I will be traveling to SUNY Quad this week, and we actually won a SUNY Quad award for this piece, and I was pretty proud, so I'll pass this around. We call this the Hopper piece. Get it, Hopper? Andrews, right. but this is a piece that flips around in a lot of different ways here. It gives you different stats and information as you go through it. So Matt Mulkin designed this, and he won an award. We're not sure if we got first or second because they changed up the way they've been doing things this year, so once we get there, I'm going to say it's first place. It's, I think it's awesome. But we'll see. Hopefully it's first place when we get there, but I'll pass this around. You can quickly take a look at it. Greg Kai will actually be presenting on why we still write press releases. This is a part two, a follow-up from something he presented 4 or 5 years ago, so it'll be exciting to see your reaction to that. And of course, it is important to still write press releases, and the 50 years on the Hill thing, I think, is evidence of that.
Yeah.
And as chair of that committee, I want to thank the committee that participated and all the folks here that participated in all the events throughout the past year. I think the highlights were definitely the Danny Fay recognition at Recognition Day and the 50-year gala, so I want to thank Anne and her staff for that. I think that was a fantastic event. And quickly, just because these folks haven't been recognized formally anywhere, I just want to list off their names. So some of them are here: Courtney Bish, Jamie Burgess, Diane Marie Collins, Pat Hongs, Lashawana Ingram, Greg Kai, Sue Law. Of course, we always need food at these events, and she did a great job. Lorette Murray, Priscilla Leggett, Ellie Prashaw, Randy Saminsky, Joffrey Vanderwood, Lenore Vanderzee, and also special thanks to Morgan Elliott and Matt Mulkin for designing the programs and the videos and all the other things that go along with this. Overall, I don't think we spent a ton of money on it, and we hit all the right notes, and I think everyone was pleased. We engaged the community. We engaged our alumni. And it was really nice to see the class of 68 back here and being so appreciative that we were honoring this milestone. And, with that,
the audiovisual department that was shown, all those videos that were shown at an event I attended, was absolutely tremendous.
Thanks.
And it made an event that probably would have been somewhat mundane into a very special occasion. So you're to be congratulated for all that.
Right.
Not just what you've mentioned, but that as well.
And what Travis didn't also mention is we've also been on the radio a lot, in magazines a lot, in the newspaper a lot.
Sorry.
And so a lot of this has been with respect to our esports initiative. And so and it shows up in all kinds of odd places, right? The most recent of which was in athletic management, I think it's called.
Yes.
Okay, which is a magazine that goes to coaches in high schools. And guess who was on the cover of it? We didn't just have a feature, you know, in an article. Our team was on the cover of it. It was the only team on the cover of
it. That's great.
All right, so that was great. We've been interviewed by Forbes, so I'm looking forward to something showing up there. Forbes is not a place SUNY Canton usually shows up. Okay, and so I'm happy about that. And so it's just showing up in all kinds of places.
And eCampus News is actually doing a three-part story on this because they're so impressed with all the things we're doing. So they want to do a piece on academics, a piece on athletics, and a third piece on, like, technology and what eSports actually is. They're not quite sure. So.
Yeah. And so we're definitely seen as a leader in this. And I should mention that I also, just after the president's meeting, I had to run up to the airport, fly to Boston, rent a car, drive to Maine for a meeting of our athletic conference. Okay, and things were very, very positive. They're very happy to have us. Right, they see us as a really key member of the conference. They're now interested in esports. Okay, and in fact, we're going to be doing a one-on-one with Maine Maritime in esports. So that'll be interesting, and Sean will be glad to know that for this conference, they've now elected me as their treasurer. So I'll be able to keep an eye on the finances. And so, anyway, so things are going well there, too. And with that, Ron, I am finished with the president's report.
I just had a question for Doug on the retention. Is there any reason it stands out? Student doesn't return?
I'll just give you the baseline. Nationwide, community college retention rate is 19%. Is that retention? No, that's graduation rate. 19%. Bachelor's degrees nationwide is 50 to 55%, slight difference between publics and privates. And of course, we're both. So beginning with the graduation rate, when I got here, of 31%, and I'm trying to think what we are. Did we hit 39%?
We did.
We did.
I think we hit 40.
We hit 40. Yay! So similar bump up. That's where we stand. My goal. I've been pretty clear with faculty that we have official goals, and I joke with them. I'm like, our official goal for retention is 73%. Mine. I said I'm not going to tell you what my personal goal is, but it rhymes with waiting. And in terms of graduation, I would love. We actually designed a new number because the official numbers are based on first time, full time freshmen. Well, so that ignores transfers. It ignores people who come in with credits. So our freshman class of 700, we've had officially first time, full time freshmen between 35 and 80 students in the denominator for the. So it's. What we want, what we decided, and also if a student comes in and is placed in an associate's degree and transfers into a bachelor's degree, in that official statistic, they're a dropout. That doesn't make sense. So we've created a number that we're calling completion that says, I don't care how you got here, you landed here, did you leave within 6 years with a certificate, associate's, or bachelor's degree? We're happy, because that means we've served you. And then you add to that the number of folks who have transferred out, because that can be a successful contribution to them. And our transfer out rate is about 30%, 30-something percent. So people going to Clarkson and so far. But so why do people not succeed? And nationwide trends, it basically comes down to three big reasons. Academic difficulties, financial difficulties, or those personal crises, those personal barriers. And so then we can think, well, what strategies can we put in place? So academic difficulties, we're looking at complete. This year we're going to be looking at developing completion loans or grants. Sometimes it's a matter of $100 or $500, and you're a senior. So that's a good investment in someone. We have the library textbook reserve program. 71%, we've spent a lot of money on textbooks, but we now have 71% of the sections have their textbook on reserve at the library. And in 17-18, those textbooks were checked out over 18,000 times. Students are pretty good consumers. They tend to use their general education textbooks in the library or electives, and they tend to buy the courses, the books in their major. So we're able to track what is serving them best, you know, what will they use in the library, and so make sure we have those. And so last year I doubled the amount of the allocation to that fund so we can keep those textbooks in place. And there are a number of other ways where we're trying to help students deal with those financial barriers to move forward. So academic difficulties, the college has had a long-standing strength in with tutoring services and culture of student support. And then, of course, those crises that come up, one of the things that we've added is the leave of absence policy, so that if someone does leave, we've streamlined the way back once whatever their problem is has been resolved. So we're trying to respond to all of those things to make sure that more of our students graduate.
Is it pretty easy to identify those students?
No. We actually sent out a flash poll in week 10 to 12 last year saying, do you intend to return? And we had 22 people say no, and more than 22 did not. And what we did is we called them and said, well, what's going on? Can we help you? And in fact, most of them said, no, I'm taking care of it. I've got it. Good. But so we actually asked them, are you coming back? It was November. Is things going on? So no, it's not easy.
Is the general student population aware that are they aware that if they're having a problem with a $200 book, that there's somebody there that might help them?
You know, this is a challenge. We want them to be aware if they are legitimately bumping into that, but we don't want to publicly say, hey, if you can't afford your books, we'll buy them for you. Because
right.
So what we do is we say they're in the bookstore, and this is where the close, intimate, but not those relationships with faculty or staff is important, so that, you know, Dr. Zaney has repeatedly walked students up to my office to say, this student needs the book in my classroom. Can you help them? And I know you work closely with students as well.
We have a student emergency fund that myself and a couple other staff started through the College Foundation a few years ago, and there are employees who give out of their paycheck to that, and others, I'm sure, who give out of that fund. And we use that sometimes for textbooks, sometimes if we want to do a one-off.
Well, those personal emergencies
but
as well.
Lots of bus tickets, lots of winter coats and other random things. So the word, unfortunately, is sort of out about that, in that we get a lot more students now coming in saying, I need a bus ticket home for XYZ. So we created a little internal policy for how to address that, because we just, the funds aren't unlimited. So.
We did the same thing we did through this email conversation of checking with Carrie Cooper to see if do they have money that they're due a refund on. And because we don't want to give this precious commodity to someone who's got money coming to them. And so we're trying to systematize that in terms of how to support the students. And in terms of academic difficulties, when Zvi came here, he set in place the 3-week feedback from faculty about students being engaged or not engaged. And I added with advisor follow-up, so that the advisors are now asked to contact students rated not engaged to discuss the feedback and create a strategy for success for the rest of the semester. We also have had an ongoing process of a program called MTS, Moving Towards Success, which is in essence a program where 24/7 a faculty member can go in and give feedback to their students about attendance, about performance, or a number of categories. And not only does that email, it's a fancy email system, but it doesn't just give the feedback to the student. It sends that feedback to their coach, to their RD, to their EOP or TRIO advisor, to their academic advisor, and it also comes in an aggregated file to administration, so that then when they come to appeal something, we happen to know what's going on academically and conduct. But so they're getting feedback at 3 weeks, well, 24/7 with this MTS program, at 3 weeks with engaged, not engaged, at 7 weeks with midterm grades, and of course, at the end of the semester with grades. Again, trying to keep us communicating with students, how are you doing, here's where you're not doing well, how can we fix it before it leads to you attriting, because that's really the thing we're trying to avoid.
Doug,
we want them to graduate.
You had mentioned, in terms of retention, You had mentioned the fact that is it sent, something is sent out to the students to fill out on the number three, which is, are you having problems yourself, personal problems?
We tried that.
I'm wondering if there's a more effective way of doing that, mm-hmm. rather than just having them fill out a piece of paper, because it's very personal. And I'll tell you what happened to me. When I was going to Holy Family School, I was having difficulty with algebra. And there were some issues in my family where my dad was having problems and so on. So it affected me scholastically. So instead of following through with the parochial school, I went to Watertown High School and did absolutely fine because I had resolved some of those personal issues. And I just wondered, and I went on to college, got my degree and all that stuff. I'm just wondering if there was a more personal way to contact those individuals who may not be able to continue, or am I opening a Pandora's box by doing that?
I believe really strongly in close, intimate.
But the
word in the field of higher education is faculty, staff, student engagement. In other words, creating strong relationships faculty or staff with students. So I've been leading this with the faculty and kind of trying to talk about a culture of engagement, both just talking about it in terms of, I laugh when I go to faculty meetings and I say, so you may have heard I'm interested in retention and graduation, and there's laughter from the faculty. And I'm like, well, I'm glad you're laughing because that means I'm hitting this and you know I'm hitting it.
Yeah.
We're all rowing in the same direction. And so there are a number of things that we've done to talk about driving engagement and retention. We've also done some specific things. For example, in Neville 9, the geography lends itself to students are doing their homework at the benches often. Faculty are walking through, cleaning up, setting up labs. So there's just a natural geography. The MacArthur building is terrible because you've got faculty offices with no reason for a student to walk by that office unless they are intentionally going to the faculty office. And the students who have problems don't go to the faculty offices, which is why they have problems. So it's a really bad geography. So how can we improve that? So across from the criminal justice suite of offices, we took an existing space and turned it into a student lounge. Because in other, like in Neville Dine, they have natural spaces that they're hanging out in. We did the same thing with a room that the psychology department is using and created a space for the faculty and students to work in. You've heard of $5 Friday, where it's discounted lunch in Cheney. I use money to pay for faculty to eat lunch in Cheney once a month. So $5 times 10 months, $50 a faculty member for whoever uses it. Because getting faculty and students together, even if they don't sit at the same table, to see them in the line, all of this is good because the more time you are in conversation with the faculty, the more likely you're going to talk about or they're going to be aware that you're having problems. And for example, in Cheney, the automotive crew is always there. They have a table. Funeral services uses it a lot. Trio is who we stole the idea from because Brenda was already doing it. And so I think any close relationship between faculty or staff and students allows that awareness of if a student is struggling for whatever reason, for there to be a conversation about fixing it. When I was in high school, my senior year was a really bad year for me personally.
Yeah.
My graduating class was 1,000 students.
Yeah.
I walked in and my advisor of a club that I was president of looked at me and said, "What's wrong?" And I just was like, barely vertical in terms of, because I was not doing well. She said, "Come with me." And she pulled me into her office. That's the kind of thing we're talking about.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I don't know that there's I think the only thing you can do is create conditions in a variety of ways that faculty can have good relationships with students so that those moments are captured. And
just to be clear,
you're not staying.
Sure. And just to be clear, it's not just the faculty.
Yeah.
Okay, our staff are very much involved in this. We have, in fact, working groups that meet weekly that look at hundreds of factors to determine who is at risk and that we need to reach out to.
Right.
Okay, and you know, and every faculty member has heard me tell the story about that no matter how high a person has risen in their professional careers, they've always had that moment where they were on the razor's edge.
Right.
And
right.
you know, the least push and they're off into oblivion.
Right.
And so you've got to be there in that moment.
That's great.
And we worked very hard
yeah.
to have
Thank
a member of our faculty, our staff, somebody, okay, be aware and be there in that moment.
It's a good way to retain students.
Oh, absolutely. I keep gesturing to Courtney, because student affairs, this is what they do all the time. But for faculty, some faculty, this is their nature, the way they engage with their students. And other faculty are more focused on their content and don't realize that, in fact, these relationships
right.
are really important as well.
That.
So to encourage them and to have them recognize that, no, that's really a valuable part of your career as well.
And it's so rewarding when you help a student go out of your way to it. You're a hero to them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the fact.
Yeah.
A lot of them keep in contact with you through
yes.
the years.
Yes, they do.
Amazing.
And this year I've gotten actually a bunch of emails from students and from parents, you know, singing the praises of various faculty. That hasn't happened before. Okay, because these are people who have reached out. Michaela can tell you we had people coming by and interrupted one of our meetings. Okay, because they wanted to thank us for something we had done, right? Neither of us had any idea what it was at this point, because you know, there'd been some months or whatever. But, you know, we're always there, right? The students still have my phone number. They still have my email address. So it's, you know, so I get texts and I get emails and they're always forwarded, right, to the right place. And so I sent one to Travis the other day, okay? And Courtney gets a never-ending stream of these things, right? And Sean gets bunches of them when it involves, you know, financial issues. Right, and so forth. So everybody does their part. Anyway, our report is done.
Okay, thank you very much, for everyone. Any other business to come before our meeting today, Tom?
Well, we had an email from Mike McCormick, and when you drive around campus, there's a lot of work going on.
Mm-hmm.
At our first meeting in the fall, would it be possible to have a presentation from Mike and then maybe a tour to
sure.
see what the improvements are,
oh,
what the results are?
Yep.
I think that would
yeah.
be.
We would
fun.
Love it. Yeah, we absolutely
oh,
would love it.
Good.
I can't tell you how happy Mike will be that you said that.
I mean, we've had. He really enjoys his job. And,
oh,
he, and over the years he's been in, and he gets all excited with the blueprints and the PowerPoint.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
if we could fire him up for 20 minutes and then have him take us on a tour.
No. Tom, you just asked for the impossible there, which was to keep it to 20 minutes. Okay? But let me, in fact, mention something that's new on this campus that you probably don't know about at all. Okay? Because sometimes it's in the small things, okay, not just the big ones. And that's as part of Alumni Weekend. When this campus was built, there was actually a person, a workman here, who lost his life okay, in the construction of this campus. And so one of the things we did for our 50th anniversary on the Hill is we invited his family okay, to come here, and we planted a tree in his honor in a central location on the campus that overlooks everything. And so his wife was there, and brothers and sisters were there, and cousins. Right, there was a good turnout from that family. And what they said to us was, we can't believe that you remembered.
That got in the paper, too.
That was a beautiful
yeah,
moment.
Nice piece.
Yeah.
Rick Hine,
yeah.
Pat Hans, and
yeah.
the foundation deserve a lot of credit for putting that together.
That's right.
Well,
it was
group,
a beautiful moment.
Greg really
right.
wanted to make that happen.
Yeah.
That's great. That's wonderful.
Soil caved in on
it,
right?
Yeah.
That was before they had those support.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
When we do the tour, could I ask that we have one of those jitneys? Mm-hmm. Old ladies like me need to keep up with the rest
sure.
of the youngsters.
Happy to do it.
That's great. Remember someone like that after 50 years. With Mike McCormick, one improvement I've noticed, I think I mentioned it to you last year. The sign by the footbridge on Riverside Drive.
Mm-hmm.
There were no dead things. They finally decided last year, I think. They have daylilies in there now. It looks really nice. Mm-hmm. At least it's not dead.
Yeah.
That's a vast improvement from my perspective. And I drove by it every day. Anything else?
Dr. MacArthur approached Mike at the gala last week and asked him what the new building was next to faculty office. He said, that's Dana Hall. He didn't even recognize the building.
Oh,
so
wow.
He was tickled with that it's changed the appearance of it already so much. And it's going to just get better and better once we get the windows and stuff. It's going to be a nice building. So, yeah, Dr. MacArthur didn't even, he didn't recognize it. So that was
something?
Nice. Yeah.
Earl looked pretty good. I didn't realize he was 90.
Yep.
Oh,
it was nice to have him and to have Joe Kennedy here and Dave Gerlach here and Ann Williams here.
Oh,
so it was really old home week.
That was,
very nice.
I sat beside I can't tell you his name, but from Ithaca, but we're talking about vet science. And because I have a friend of mine, their granddaughter, left St. Lawrence to go to SUNY Potsdam. She wants to be a veterinarian. And to save money, she left St. Lawrence and went to SUNY Potsdam and graduated. She applied to 3 colleges for trying to be a veterinarian and denied at all 3. There's a huge application fee, too. But anyway, this guy turns out to be a surgeon. Ithaca, I think. And the reason he came to SUNY Canton was he wanted to be a veterinarian. He went to that tech first. He couldn't get into that school or college. Isn't that amazing? That's astounding.
So we've had students from our program now getting into vet school.
Yeah.
And so that's increasing now.
That's great.
And Earl MacArthur's story, I've got to tell you. Tom would know. Glenn Goff. Anyway. When I had a lot of hair and was doing television news at Channel 7, I got no respect, actually. But on this one occasion, Dr. MacArthur and Glenn Goff got together, and Glenn, every night during the late news, would ask me a sports question, and I would try to get the answer. Well, the two of them got together, and the question was this. Who was the player who played for the New York Rangers and the New York Knicks in the same year? And I said, holy God, Glenn, I'm on the air, you know. I said, I have no clue. And he said, Gail Gooding, and she played the organ. You know what I mean? I had no respect at all, you know? But anyway, that was Earl MacArthur's big joke when they saw him at the event the other night. And Glenn also sent his regards. I talked to Glenn before I attended. There's no respect at all. So.
Okay, Rodney Dangerfield.
Yeah, Rodney Dangerfield. Okay, the chair will entertain a motion to into executive session to discuss roughly something under D of the open meeting law.
So
and
second.
John, second? Second by Rudy. I'll excuse everyone except the president. And did you want John or not?
He's certainly welcome to stay if you're okay with that.
Down.
Sure.
Thank you all for coming.
For our hilarious part today, John,